Good morning. Good morning and welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Church of Kent. I'm Eric Van Bars. I have the honor and privilege of serving as one of the worship associates for this congregation. And I am joined today by a guest, Gail Woosley, who is a commissioned lay leader from the Worcester UU Church. So we're delighted to have Gail with us this morning. In addition to Gail, we have Lily Rappaport. And then our music director, Hal Walker, has taken ill, and by the graces and wonderfulness of our community, we have music associate director Vanessa Vesley filling in. It's a title she well deserves. And Katie Grigg Miller and Saunas Parson are also helping us with music today. So it's wonderful to have such collaborative colleagues within the congregation who can join at a moment's notice and create a wonderful musical program for you. Our chalice will be lit today by a member of the congregation, Cheryl Spohr.
Our chalice lighting is called, Deep Calls Unto Deep, Joy Calls Unto Joy, and it is by Gordon McKean. Deep calls unto deep, joy calls unto joy, light calls unto light, but the kindling of this flame may kindle in us the inner light of love, of peace, of hope. As one flame lights another, nor grows the less, we pledge ourselves to be bearers of the light wherever we are.
Our opening words are by Michael DeVernon Boblett. May the walls of this house be strong in the face of storms, whether of winds or of words, whether of thunder or of tyranny. May the windows of this house be clear to the world's light, whether of dawns or of daring, whether of sunsets or of stillness. May the foundations of this house be firm upon the good earth, whether of soil or of sharing, whether of bedrock or of behavior. May the doors of this house be wide to all that come from afar, whether poems or people, whether songs or strangers. May this house embrace, like a graceful chalice, the flame it cannot define or limit, as a heart enshrines hopes larger than its beating walls. Great, great Spirit who guides us, our thoughts on everyone who's gone this week, especially with another tragedy in our country. Our minds and hearts are heavy with sorrow for the families and victims and loved ones in Florida. And we pray that this nation will find a way to resolve these great tragedies as they happen again and again and again. We are so glad to be here together, joining in our joy and to support one another in this community, as we know life is precious and must be supported and loved and honored in order for us as a people to move forward. The signs are in our world, in the temperature, in the buds in our yards and on the side of the road, where we know spring once again will come and life is eternal. Blessed it be, and may it be so.
Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both, and be one traveler long I stood, and looked down one as far as I could, to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then took the other as just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim, because it was grassy and wanted wear. Though as for that, the passing there had worn them really about the same. And both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I saved the first for another day. Yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh, somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference.
So I've been wrapped up in watching the Winter Olympics this week. Now, I'm not really a sports fan, but I love the human drama and the cultural pageantry that the Olympics provides, and figure skating. Yeah, the combination of artistry, technique, and all those sequins, it just gets me every time, and I've been up till 3 a.m. watching. And also Korea. I've really enjoyed watching the Olympics broadcast from Pyeongchang because I lived in Korea for 5 months in 2014 and have a real fondness for Korean people, their customs, and above all, their food. But one thing I remember from my Korean friends is a tradition that's greatly affected me, and that's the practice of giving with a gift with both hands. In Korea, it's polite to extend both hands when giving and receiving a gift. It's bad form if you don't. And there are many gifts in Korea. Anything from a handshake, a cup of tea, a small bag of potato chips or cookies is considered a gift. Now, Korean folklore has two theories of how this came about. One is that the custom dates from the practice of using both hands so that the person will see that you're not concealing a weapon. But I prefer the less skeptical theory, and that is that extending both hands implies that you are totally immersed in the act of giving. So giving with two hands evokes an energy that's contagious and rouses the confidence knowing that you are doing the right thing. Intentions and actions are in alignment and results in a feeling of responsiveness. Now, this type of conscious giving does not allow room for feeling obligated or holding expectations of others. Giving with two hands changes things up so that an individual authentically feels the joy as they are extending their energy and experiencing life. I think of our experiences here, opening doors together, new doors, because I started thinking about the beautiful new building that we will have when the completion of our fellowship hall. Now that is a big two-handed gift. And the joy we will have of opening these doors together with two hands. Take a moment to think of the gifts this church has provided me, because I think of this gift, this church, as a gift. A spiritual home is a precious gift, and it's best presented in a very old-fashioned ceremony way. It goes like this. Here is the church. Here is the steeple. Open the doors. Here are the people. And you give with two hands when you finish that. I struggle with being mindful to the act of giving and to examine my intentions consciously, feeling at home in the act of giving, to practice what we refer to every Sunday here as that fragile art of hospitality. It means that doing things that I want to do, I do things with purpose, choose experiences that make me feel good, and proceed with purpose. Now, my actions really have been influenced by this thought of giving with two hands. It means that when I give of my time, my energy, my resources, my money, I give wholeheartedly to whoever, whenever, and whomever I want to. I've struggled to come to this, but I realized that it's really not the size of the gift, but the impact of giving that creates gratitude. To draw upon the words of Mother Teresa, At the end of life, we will not be judged by how many diplomas we have received, how much money we have made, how many great things we have done. We will be judged by, I was hungry and you gave me to eat. I was naked and you clothed me. I was homeless and you took me in. Hungry not only for bread, but hungry for love. Naked not only for clothing, but naked for human dignity and respect. Homeless not only for a want of a room of bricks, but homeless because of rejection. So whatever the situation, our power lies in the awareness of keeping our head and heart together in whatever we do and giving the gift of home. Remaining grounded with practices that match personal beliefs provides the home for my true self to emerge and give, not help, give. Whether a handshake, a cup of tea, or extending welcome into my spiritual home, I'm making a conscious effort to experience life by giving myself the extraordinary gift of giving with two hands.
Good morning. Thank you for having me here this morning. We traveled up from Worcester on some snowy roads, but we got here in one piece, and that was good. My friend Ivy came with me. My wife sits on the stewardship committee, and we just started our annual campaign, so you know what she's doing. We got here this morning and went to the front door and it was locked. We thought, well, that can't be a good sign. My name's on the sign outside. Obviously, I've got to find a way in here. So we walked around the building and we found someone carrying in beautiful roses and followed her in through your maze downstairs. Some years ago, my spouse and I was getting ready for retirement, which I did last year in May. Wonderful thing. Do it. I highly encourage it. After 44 years in healthcare, I decided enough was enough. And so I retired, but to do that, we had to make some preparations. So we sold our big place in the country, 7 acres, 3,000 square foot house, horses, cats, you name it, and we moved to a half acre in town. That adjustment wasn't so bad. It really wasn't. We were both ready, and after we had had one horrible, horrible winter, and I got tired of being on my tractor when it was 20 below trying to keep the lane clear so that I could get out, we decided it was time to downsize a bit. So we bought a house, and of course, a house you buy always needs things, so we got new windows and realized the first winter that we needed a new front door because we could just feel the wind coming through it. So as we went through this process, we looked at four things when we looked at our front door. We wanted it pleasing in appearance to those coming through it. We wanted it functional, we wanted quality, and my wife looked at cost because that's what she does. So we finally found the door that we wanted, matched the outside to the rest of the house, and then the inside. The salesman says, what color do you want the inside? And my spouse says, well, let's make it the same color as the walls. And I said, what if I paint? So that kind of went out the window. And I said, I want it red. She said, you got to be kidding. I said, no, I want it red. It has to be red. We had everything else accented in cranberry and red. I said, I'm going to pay $5,000 for a door. By the way, entry doors are very expensive. I said, I'm paying $5,000 for a door. I want people to see it when they're sitting here in my living room. And so the red won out, and it looks marvelous. But it got me to thinking about all of the doors I had gone through in my life. So I'm going to talk about a few of those doors. Randy and I grew up in the same small town in Iowa, a little town called Oxford Junction, Iowa, 600 people. And I had lived there until I was 30 because no one actually told us because we were free to go. You know, so I finally left Iowa and I moved to Seattle, Washington. I had relatives in that area and I kind of had made a, flipped a coin. I do a lot of coin flipping, you'll find out. Flipped a coin and thought it's either Phoenix or it's Seattle. I had been to Phoenix, I'd not been to Seattle. So I went to see a cousin out there and said, yep, this is where I want to be. So lived out there for 18 years. And during that time, I had had several jobs in healthcare, and the job I had at the time that I started having issues. I was working for the Boeing company. Now, the Boeing company is a fascinating, amazing company. It truly is. And I was in healthcare, so I worked in occupational medicine. And we ended up having, the area I worked in, we ended up having a meeting every Wednesday morning with the same action items. It would last anywhere between 1 to 3 hours for 2.5 years. So I'm sitting at my kitchen table one Wednesday morning, and I had been getting angrier and angrier. It's a good thing I only had 8 blocks to work because I couldn't be on the freeway. That was just a bad thing. I just got angry at everybody. And so sitting in my kitchen that morning, that Wednesday morning, having coffee, as I normally did, and my first cigarette of the day, I'm thinking, oh, I've got the Penn status meeting this morning. I can't seem to please my boss. She's just like my father. Boom, realization. Going, ooh, this is not going to be a good day, and it wasn't. So needless to say, between everything that happened and my attitude going into that meeting, I walked out of the meeting angry, and my boss came to me and said, I think it's probably time that you see somebody and deal with some of this. So she sent me to EAP for the Boeing company, who had then had referred me to a therapist. And I had a lot of stuff from my childhood that weighed on me. I grew up Jehovah's Witness, so I had that kind of guilt going on. Didn't have a lot of contact with my parents, so I had that going on. And so all of these things had piled up, and here I am, you know, 36 years old, thinking, I got to get my game together here. So I see the person from EAP, refers me to a therapist. It's close to my house, didn't have to drive far. That was a good thing. That's why I chose her. And so I'm sitting outside of this door that I'm afraid to go through. I don't want to go through this door because, again, my father's voice is in the back of my head. You don't need these people if you live right. Okay, well, apparently I wasn't living right. So that guilt was going on. So I go to the door. I'm early. I am habitually early every place I go because I think it's just a good practice. And I found that being a UU, there aren't people who are habitually early. That's just the way it is. UUs have their own time zone. I call it UU time, you know, and it's great. So I go and I wait and I look at my watch and I have this appointment with this person I don't know and to discuss things I don't want to discuss. And I'm sitting in my car. And I thought, do I go in or do I go home? Because I had the .357 loaded. I had my notes written. I was ready to commit suicide at that point in time. So I flipped the coin. Again, coin flipping. Heads I go in, tails I go home. It was heads. I went, okay, best 2 out of 3. Flipped the coin again, and it was heads. I walked through that door. Found a wonderful, wonderful person who actually literally saved my life. And went through all of the things I had to go through to get to a good place. It was like peeling an onion, you know, it took months and months and months to do this. And she has now passed away from cancer, but she was a marvelous person and made me work. I'd get home after I'd see her and I'd cry for like 2 hours, which was great. It was a wonderful way to vent. Finally, I met my spouse and as soon as we met, we knew that we were for each other. Met through a personal ad. And from the day we met, we talked on the phone. 3 days later, she moved in. And we got legally married in 2015 after a 21-year engagement. Had to go to Iowa to do it, but now we're legally married everywhere, okay? But anyway, a wonderful, wonderful thing. So that was one of my horrible, horrible situations with that personal door that I didn't want to go through. The second door that scared me to death was a door located at 3186 Burbank Road in Worcester, Ohio. That was the door to the UU Fellowship. Didn't want to go through that door. I had been unchurched for years, and I thought, why should I go into something else, aspire to something else, that was going to be just as meaningless to me as the religion I left? But I agreed to go with my wife, and because I love her, I went with her. But I was like a little kid. She had me really by the hand, and I had those heels dug in. I didn't want to go in. But I went in those doors. And we went on a Sunday that was called Humor Sunday, which was a Sunday where they made fun of themselves and everybody else. And so we're sitting here during the sermon. We're sitting way in the back, of course, because I wanted a quick exit. Sitting way in the back and listening to this, and I leaned over to my wife about halfway through the sermon. I said, "These people are nuts." She said, "Yeah, they are." I said, "I like it." And we've been going ever since. And we met some wonderful people. We had moved from Seattle to Ohio in 2003, and we didn't go to the UU until 2009, where we actually found community. We had aunts and uncles. Bonnie had aunts and uncles in Worcester because she was born in Worcester, but we really didn't have community until we walked into the UU. And so we got involved very quickly, joined about 3 months later. And so she's been on music committee and stewardship, and I've been on, I take care of the pastoral care committee, and I'm on the worship associates committee. I also am a CLM, so I do sermons. I also am on the intern minister committee. I chair that because we have an intern minister right now. And so, yeah, we've gotten involved, very involved, and we stay involved because it's what's important to us. So, of those two doors, those were the ones that bothered me the most as far as the literal doors. Now, I go through that door every Sunday, and it doesn't make me afraid. And a little side note to that particular door. In June of 2015, we were getting ready to move into our new house. We hadn't signed the papers yet, but we were cleaning out and moving and doing what we had to do. And we happened to stop at the UU because Bonnie needed to pick something up. And we were standing in front of the doors of the UU, and Bonnie looked at her phone and she said, "We're married." And I said, "Well, yeah, honey, I was there, you know, a few years ago in Iowa. I know that." She said, "No, Supreme Court, we're married." And we were standing in front of the doors of the UU. And it was so very touching to both of us. And the secretary came out, wanted to know why we were crying. And we told her, and then she started to cry. So we had a cry fest on the front doorstep, which was marvelous. But so I'm not afraid of that door anymore. But there are those doors in our lives that we go through that we are happy to go through most times. But then again, those doors can change for us. A marriage turns bad. The wife doesn't want to go home because of domestic violence. She's afraid. Or a spouse loses a partner and they don't want to go home because that's where their life was. So those doors can change for us, and they can change quickly. And it's our choice whether we decide to go through it or not. So we've talked about literal doors. Let's talk about the metaphorical doors for a little bit. This last couple years, some of those metaphorical doors that have been opened have been very, very scary to me. That door to racism, the door to hate, the door to bigotry. Those are doors that are always there that we would love to remain closed in our society, but they don't. So how do we battle those? How do we keep those doors closed in our heart and in our minds? And that's a difficult, difficult thing to do on a daily basis, but it starts with each and every one of us, whether or not we open that door. And once it's open, it's very hard to get closed. But there are some doors that may be metaphorical doors that are closed that maybe should be open. The door to love, the door to compassion. Someone who has not had a relationship, it's very hard to open up that door to your heart and let someone in because you're always afraid of being hurt. That's a decision that you have to make on a daily, monthly, even hourly basis at times. You go through your doors at church, at college, at work. You deal with open-minded people, with closed-minded people. You deal with them on a daily basis. There's one more door that I really haven't talked about too much that we have absolutely no control over. And that is what I call the trap door. You're walking along and you're doing just fine. Suddenly the ground opens up beneath you and something happens and you're in this trap door. And you don't know how to get out. A friend of mine had a house that she had been working on since she started to build it. And needless to say, a relationship ended for her and she had never really finished the molding on the house. I had just left a position at the hospital and took some time off, decided to get out of management. And so we had met and I had said, well, I'd done finish work before. And she said, I said, I'd be willing to help you finish your house. She said, are you sure about this? And I said, yeah, I'm sure about this. I looked at her house and I went, oh boy. Anyway, because it was a big house. But she was buying all the wood raw. She was staining it herself and muttering. I mean, she was doing beautiful work and I do nice work. So we decided to finish it together. And there's a story about a man who's walking along and falls in a hole. And so anyway, he's in this hole. He cannot get out. So he sees his doctor up above. He says, hey, doc, I'm in this hole. Can you help me out? So the doctor writes a prescription and throws it down in the hole at him. Well, that's helpful. So pretty soon, he sees his minister walk past. And he says, hey, Father, I'm in this hole. I need help. So he writes a prayer out and throws it down at him. Well, that doesn't help. He's still in the hole. Pretty soon, a friend walks by. He says, hey, Joe, I'm down in this hole. Can you help me out? And so the friend jumps in the hole with him. He said, are you nuts? He says, no, we're both in the hole. And Joe says, yeah, but I've been here before, and I know the way out. So if you've got good friends, good social structure, and people who are willing to help you as your community, when you fall in that hole, that's a good thing. So I jumped in the hole with this friend of mine. 18 months later, we finished this house, and it's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. I am so proud of the work that we did on this. And we worked together again for 18 months. It was also kind of an 18-month-long therapy session because she had so much anger toward her partner who just packed up and left that she needed to talk about this. So for the first 12 months, it was talking about this, getting this out, making her understand that if you could right now drop everything and she would come back to you, do you want her back? The question I finally asked her after 12 months. I said, don't answer now. I want you to think about it for a few minutes and I'm going to go, you know, get the coping saw so I can put the molding next to the bathroom counter. Okay. And she finally thought about it and she said no. And that was a turning point in her life. I wouldn't want her back. And that was the best thing that probably happened to her. And we're still friends. But now she needs to sell the house and get something smaller because all of her kids are gone. So we've talked about those doors that we walk through every day, the doors to this church. Ivy and I were greeted very warmly when we found an open door because the front one was locked. So we went in the back because I said, nah, they're not going to stop me. I'm going to the back door. So we went to the back door. Doors to work, the doors to our homes, nursing homes, hospitals, doctor's offices. We talked about the doors of hatred, of bigotry, and racism, which we want to keep out of our lives at all costs. And how we fight those through social justice. We fight those doors. And then our own personal trap doors. Now, if you have a person that keeps falling in the same trap door month after month, maybe they need more than our help. But it's up to you. It's up to you as far as what you want to do with your life, the basic decisions you make, and how you make them. It's up to us to keep those doors of hate out of our hearts and to live in a community where we don't have that inside these walls. Blessed be.
We are here at this threshold. We are here. We who have crossed many thresholds already to arrive at this space and time, coming out from identities that didn't embrace the fullness of who we are, coming across distances, boundaries, discoveries that have beckoned to us deeper in life and challenged us to change, coming with our loves, our partners, our children, our memories, our wisdom and our willingness, coming to our senses, our awareness of critical issues that threaten the well-being of the Earth's creatures, communities, and cultures. We are here at this threshold, the threshold of a house of study where minds are set on fire, the threshold of a house of spirit where prayer and contemplation take us deeper, and the threshold of a house of hope for greater justice and compassion in the world. The threshold of a house of preparation for the thresholds that will lead others to cross, for the thresholds yet to come, and for the thresholds the world stands on, for the possibilities between violence and the possibilities of peace. Come, let us now cross that threshold together. Go in peace.